Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile.
With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
This is the Game Football Podcast from The Times. Today, have Gareth Southgate and his England side proven a point with their World Cup qualification? And can their youngsters stake a claim for Qatar? Meanwhile, Scotland have liftoff under Steve Clarke. Can they make it as well? Will Dean Smith rescue Norwich? And who's the greatest British player of all time? This is The Game. Welcome back. England are into the World Cup. They finished top of Group I. They battered Albania 5-0 at Wembley before their massive, record-breaking 10-0 win in San Marino. Harry Kane scored four, got a hat-trick against Albania at Wembley as well. It is the first time England have scored 10 in a World Cup or Euros qualifier. In fact, it's the first time they've scored 10 since May of 1964 against the United States. I'm Hugh Woozencroft. Let's start with England. Alison Rudd, Gregor Robertson and Tom Clarke with me for the next hour or so. And look, I'm going to dive straight in with the sensationalist stuff. You know, it's the time, so that's what we do. Harry Maguire, the England centre-back, he scored the first goal against Albania. He cupped his ears. He put his fingers in his ears. A centre-back doing a knee slide should be banned. We'll leave that to one side. He got called embarrassing by the former Manchester United captain, Roy Keane. So, Alison, has Harry Maguire over the past couple of games answered any of his critics in any way whatsoever?
By doing a knee slide? No. There's a dual narrative for Harry Maguire, and he's got to get his head round it. So I'm prepared to cut him some slack for going over the top and his reaction to the crowd. He's got his narrative at Manchester United and his narrative with England. And with England, it's been a reasonable trajectory, chosen when he wasn't with a top six club. They loved the way he would... England management loved the way he would bring the ball out of defence. He's our type of defender. He's comfortable on the ball, reliable at the back. And we like the way he gets forward and can threaten to score. And he seemed like, I don't know, it's the sort of defender England needed. There was a lot of rabbits in headlights stuff going on at that time. So that looked like, it felt like he was perfect. And then he got his move to Manchester United, which has been tricky. And of course, regardless of how well or badly United are doing, it's a different type of pressure, and you're expected to put in different type of performances when you're playing for a club that's supposed to be the biggest club in the world. So he has struggled. I think he's probably wrong to in a way converge the narratives, and that's what he's been doing. So when I look at him, I see somebody who almost isn't quite sure who he is anymore, and he was just so relieved to feel useful that he put that sort of relief reaction out there. But it doesn't answer your critics, because the opponents have been so ridiculously weak, and it does look slightly embarrassing if you're overexcited about trouncing a part-time pub team. So no, he hasn't answered his critics, but I will cut him some slack, because I think it's been a tricky few years for Harry Maguire.
Gregor, have you ever had one of these moments, you know, roundly criticised by the Grimsby Comet, and you score a towering header?
Sorry.
Grimsby Telegraph, excuse me, yeah, and criticised roundly, but you know, responding with a big goal and a big celebration? Please tell me you have.
No.
Do you think Harry Maguire did answer anyone? Anyone at all?
No, look, it wouldn't have done him any harm to score a couple of goals. But when he goes back to Man United, the spotlight will be back on him again. That's the same with Harry Kane. This will help him. It will give him a massive boost of confidence, because both players have endured difficult starts to the Premier League season. But answering critics, no, I think he needs to kind of, he needs to up his game in the Premier League to do that.
Finally on this, Tom, should the likes of Roy Keane stay out of it? Is it a little bit over the top, a little bit, you know, he called Harry Maguire embarrassing, but is it embarrassing for Roy Keane to criticise the captain of the club that he used to play for in this way publicly?
Perhaps in this context, yeah, perhaps in an international context in relation to England, yes. I think Roy Keane actually has been proved to make some quite pertinent points about Manchester United, as we've discussed recently. But yeah, I think when it comes to England, I do get the sense sometimes that with some of the punditry, it's a little bit deliberately sensationalist. And, you know, everything with England under Gareth Southgate is a positive often, which is why a lot of the players like joining up with England. You know, Raheem Sterling is another one who's talked about it before in terms of club v country. That's a great position for Southgate and for England to be in, that these players, particularly when you see quite a lot of players dropping out of the squad, and, you know, most of them will probably be featuring in the Premier League fairly soon, I'm sure, those little injuries and knocks. It's great that he's got players like Maguire, Kane, who are desperate to play, want to play in these games where really they could go, nah, boss, I'm all right. Leave me on the bench.
Let's move to Harry Kane next then. A few records broken in the 10-0 win over San Marino. Kane's the first player since Tommy Taylor in the 1956-7 season to score a hat-trick in consecutive caps for England's men. And he's the first England male player to score four goals in a game since Ian Wright against San Marino back in 1993. These two games, I think, were good for Harry Kane's confidence. I got to speak to him on Friday. He says the manager, Gareth Southgate, and his new club manager, Antonio Conte, want him to be a penalty box player. So all of this dropping deep, Tom, I know you respected him for last season. It's done. What does that mean for Harry Kane? Will we see the best of him now?
Poor old Harry Kane, eh? Honestly, just when we've just got used to this new dropping deep role, he's got to change it all up again. Look, it will be good. It did feel a little bit watching it like the big lad in the playground, didn't it? Particularly against San Marino. Give me the ball. I want to score another one. Give me the ball. No, I'm taking the penalty. I don't know whether that's necessarily a good thing. I want to be in the box, all this kind of stuff. He's a complete forward, and I think that's incredibly limiting to say, get in the box, Harry. I don't really think that will necessarily suit him or England or Tottenham, personally.
It depends how well the team around him's functioning. Let's be brutally honest. There was nothing to learn from England's game against San Marino. I think Albania, first half, England were outstanding. Mm-hmm. And, like, you know, Albania are a great footballing nation, but they collected 18 points in the group, and they're not absolute mugs. And England made them look like mugs in the first half. And Harry Kane was a big part of that. He's, you know, that kind of bicycle kick finish as well. You think, wow, this is, yeah, he's an elite striker. So getting the best from him, and as I say, a kind of functioning attack around him, that's Conte's biggest challenge. And England's, really. And the thing about, particularly the first half against Albania, was the extent to which the midfield were supporting and were pushing on. You know, both Henderson and Phillips were, you know, really pressing and supporting in attack as well, and getting up around Kane. And, you know, Henderson in particular was linking well with him. So I think it's all, you know, yes, you want Harry Kane in the box finishing off opportunities, but you can only do that if he's getting the supply.
Reece James, by the way, as well, absolutely fantastic from wing back. I enjoyed the wing back system, gotta say, against Albania on Friday night, and it was a great atmosphere too. Gareth Southgate said he wanted to give the crowd over 80,000 inside Wembley a performance. I think they got that as well. And I think the reports on Friday were that Gareth Southgate will stay in charge of England until the next Euros 2024. Good decision.
Yes, of course it's a good decision.
Doubled his salary though, £6 million apparently. Is he worth that?
Bargain. Trusting Gareth, remember? Trusting Gareth, guys. Absolute bargain.
If you were on the FA board and you were doing your pros and cons and writing a list of all the things Gareth has done and Gareth could possibly do, then you would keep him on and you would probably give him a pay rise. I think it's more interesting. We all know how decent a bloke he is, how eloquent he is. He's got a lot of young players almost adoring him. That didn't used to happen with the England setup. He seems to be managing Premier League managers very well. So it's been flipped now. So it used to be the England managers would just bemoan the fact they hardly knew the players And they had to get on the phone to managers and beg for players to be released and do deals, packs, saying, I promise I'll only pay him for 40 minutes. I won't play him for more. No. It was like the balance of power was completely in favour of the Premier League clubs. And now you get managers having to speak in the press conferences, boosting the confidence of the players that they're cross that the England manager isn't using. I mean, it's completely flipped it on its head. There's a lot of young talent, and the fact that they're keen to at least make their country equal to their club is a huge step in the right direction. So if I had power at the FA, I would like that about him. The only doubt about Southgate is when it comes to the absolute crunch, you know, two tournaments on the trot, he's made the same mistakes. And did they do an interview with him? Has he told them, I know what I'd do next time? I mean, I don't really get the impression he's going to change. And there's always a doubt that with so many tweaks, so many young players coming through, that lack of experience will again rear its head when it comes to the crunch games in the next tournament and the one after that.
I'm keen to read this feature, Alison Rudd, If I Had Power at the FA. Get it commissioned, Tom. What do you think, Craig? Does he deserve the extended contract? Does he deserve the increased salary? And what do you think he can deliver? When he took over, England were 12th, I think, in the world rankings, now up to the top three.
Does he deserve it? Absolutely. Does he deserve the pay rise? I think if you're in Southgate's position and you can say I'm the most successful England manager since Alf Ramsey, then it's a pretty good bargaining position.
Alf Ramsey was on a quid a week, probably. So yeah. It's a lot bigger salary, I think.
This is the world we live in. That's the going rate for whether he is a top manager or not. He's done more than any England manager, as we say, for 50 odd years. So absolutely, what can he do? Again, it was Albania, but I was watching that first half and thinking, I mean, really, you're in that group of favourites for any major tournament now. That's what England are. You should have very little to complain about, I think. Although I know you're picking over, you know, picking the bones of the way you've exited the last two major tournaments, which is fair enough. But I agree. The other thing, watching that, you know, you're saying you like the 3-4-3. It also made you realise that when England play with that kind of intensity, it really doesn't matter about the system. We pour over it. We're as guilty as anyone. Yeah. Should England have one or two in midfield, or four at the back, three at the back? It actually, when they play like that, with that kind of intent and desire intensity, it kind of doesn't matter.
Yeah.
And they looked very well balanced as well in that game. And again, it is Albania. Mm. But they looked like a proper team. And they could win the World Cup.
I mean, I said after that game, if England played with that application, intensity, power, you know, they would be, I think, a force to be reckoned with by any team. If they, especially in that first half against Albania, were playing against one of the top teams in the world, we would have a chance of winning. We've got quality. Every individual player has enough quality for an international squad. The bench is deep. It is all about how England perform on the evening. But I think that was a step forward, even though it was against Albania. But Tom, a lot of people, I think, when we've got to the end of the qualification and the way that it ended, of course, with a 10-0 victory over San Marino, raising questions over, I think, the strength of qualification in the UEFA pools. James Gearbrandt's written about the ease of England's qualification. You can read that in today's Times as well. And I tend to agree with him. If you actually look at the World Cup qualification groups in Europe, four of the 10 games came down to what was essentially a playoff between the top two teams, and another group came to the final game with the top two teams level on points. So I don't really think there's a need to question qualification, even though we had Andorra and San Marino in our group. I still think England were one of the teams that made qualification look easy, and that should be a credit to them.
Absolutely, yeah. And I think James makes the other point that a lot of other big nations find it difficult at times. And, you know, we can all, you don't have to go very far back to the golden generation and Sven-Goran Eriksson and England making it very, very difficult for themselves in games where Gareth Southgate and the boys would have won 3-0 and said, thanks very much, see you later. So, and James also makes the very interesting point that I think is probably true, that we'll end up heading down a route where the San Marinos of this world will be pocketed off into a pre-qualification type group system where it's kind of tables to reach the final end goal, probably, which might make things more competitive and interesting for England. But for now, as Gregor says, I really just think, well, let's be grateful for how easy Southgate makes it look.
Hang on a minute, though.
You don't want San Marino involved, do you?
No.
You're anti-San Marino.
James also makes the point that this is egalitarian. Mm. This is pure competition. Nobody determines the result beforehand. It's 11 men against 11 men. Well, they don't. I mean, that sounds very pleasant. But if you're good and you're from San Marino, you don't play for San Marino. You go off. You just go off.
And play for who?
Well, you just make sure your grandmother, you will have an Italian grandmother, so you just go off. I mean, there's no.
But that's a failing of a different system, though, isn't it? That's not a failing of the way the World Cup qualifying is set up. That's surely a separate.
There's been no progression. If you're San Marino and you're bottom, I mean, there's no progression there. They are relentlessly rubbish. And they're not trying to make themselves better. They've had the same coach for 5 years or something. I mean, it's like...
Never mind putting her in charge of the English FA. Put her in charge of the San Marino FA.
But
do it.
But it's. I think we're being patronising to say, oh, it's wonderful that they're in England's group every 5 minutes. We faced them, what, 8 or 9 times in the past 8 years or something? I mean, it's ridiculous.
It's not wonderful that they're in England's group. It's wonderful that
they're
there.
It's wonderful that they're there. And it's not wonderful that they're there because they're not looking after themselves.
There are many.
They're not improving.
Probably saying that without any real knowledge of San Marino's workings.
They don't look better now than they did 10 years ago.
Okay.
Yeah, but should every team look better? I mean, there are loads of mid-tier teams that we would feel nothing about because they finish in the middle of groups all the time, and they're probably not going anywhere either. They haven't improved, but they've got some better players, so they get 10 points in a qualification group instead of 2 points, and we don't even think about them.
Where's the progression? Where's the sense of we can turn our tininess into an asset, like Iceland did? I mean, you look at Iceland, the size of Croydon, and they made their... how tiny they were work for them because they said, look, we all know each other. People watching us, they're related to us. There's a connection. They had that power of family.
But they didn't have an Italian grandmother. So they all played for Iceland. So it goes back to what you said. I agree with you then in that regard.
No one makes you find a relative. You just go for it. I don't know. I just don't think we should be patronisingly nice to Sam. Isn't it lovely that they're there? Because
if we were in their position, would you say that?
If
you were from San Marino, would you not want to be in a qualification group with England?
I'd be petitioning to have a better organisation so that we can actually cause an upset. What's the point of watching a game? I disagree with James Gearbrandt when he said it was 11 men against 11 men and anything can happen. No, it couldn't. And that's what most other clubs and countries do. They make you have that sense of something could happen. It never happens for them.
But isn't every sport like that? At least you want to be...
The thing is, they're a nation. That's the important thing.
Barely a nation. I mean, barely.
Well, they are, and that's why they're allowed to enter. So, personally, I think that should always be the case.
Then it's a privilege, and they should use that privilege to somehow...
That's their choice.
...somehow improve.
That's their choice.
Right, I didn't think we'd be arguing about San Marino's place in world football, but there you are. Anything can happen on this podcast rather than in football. Listen, let's talk a little bit more, unless anyone wants to add something on the qualification. Do you want to see it changed or anything like that? Everyone's happy? Right, let's move on a little bit and talk about another piece in the Times today. And it's around 50 debutants for England so far. Under Gareth Southgate's reign, Conor Gallagher becoming the latest, the 50th player to make a debut after Jesse Lingard back in 2016. But the piece also talks about some of the players who've made their debuts under Southgate and their importance or future importance in the England side. Declan Rice is the first player to be outlined, Tom. And I think he is very important, very, very important. A lot hinges on him in terms of Gareth Southgate and how he wants to play. Jordan Henderson came back in this squad and looked very, very good, particularly against Albania as well. Do you think he can stake a claim to be in that midfield when we get to the next World Cup?
I think Henderson's experience always gives him a chance, but I think the Rice-Phillips combo has to be leading the way so far. I mean, of all the nonsense that I've talked on this podcast over the last couple of years, when I said that I didn't think Declan Rice was a midfielder and that he was a ball-playing defender, that's probably up there, isn't it, in terms of the biggest load of rubbish, because increasingly, both for West Ham and England, he just looks absolutely dominant in midfield. His ability to bring the ball forward, his passing, just continues to impress. And as the piece mentions by Willis, he kind of sets England's tempo quite a lot of the time, particularly in these games against the lower nations, when... your Sterlings, your Canes are kind of being tightly man-marked further up the pitch. It's on Rice to quicken the tempo, to find a pass, to cut through an opposition two banks of defence. So he starts for me in midfield. He's probably the cliche, one of the first names on the team sheet at the moment, I would say, along with kind of the likes of Kane and Sterling.
There were some players mentioned in the piece as well, and a couple I've thrown in myself, in terms of the future. Maybe we should discuss this more. The future of England squad when we go to Qatar next year. Bukayo Saka, Jude Bellingham have made their debuts under Southgate. As I mentioned, Conor Gallagher, Emil Smith-Rowe getting his first England goal against San Marino as well. Those players, do you see any of them over the next, well, not even 18 months, a year really, staking a claim, a real claim to be at the forefront in terms of England's lineup?
I'm not entirely sure how they do that. I don't know.
Well, Jude Bellingham plays Champions League football. Yeah. Oh, you mean for the country?
Yeah, no, I mean, I don't know how Southgate and his team decide some of those on the list are going to be one-cap wonders or get very minimal exposure with the team after their cap, and how others are given many more chances, because it's not
say names.
Name
names. Who are you
Trent.
Thinking of? Who's not getting the opportunity, and who is getting an opportunity they don't deserve, in your opinion? Then?
No. There's a lot of talent there, but at some, I just feel Southgate's a bit of a people pleaser, and I think he likes giving people their debut.
Boo.
And I think
in this horrible world, there's nought wrong with people pleasers, Alison Rudd. What is going on? You won tennis this morning as well. What is happening?
If I was England manager, it must be a lovely, lovely thing to do, to pick up the phone and tell somebody, I'm choosing you for your country. And your country is England. It's not San Marino. It's England. And you're going to get a cap. And you make someone happy. And as we all know, they then do an interview saying how happy it's made their mum. And it's like, oh, yeah, you know.
I don't bring the mums into it as well.
So it's a lovely thing to do, but I just don't think it's terribly productive from a management point of view, because you're just throwing a juggler, and you're throwing another ball at you, and you're juggling more and more. And I don't know how you properly assess how they're going to integrate. I'm a great believer in, I'd love England to have players in it that are non-fashionable, but they're there because they just know how England tick, and they know how Gareth ticks, and they're always going to be there regardless of whether they suddenly come through at Arsenal or Crystal Palace or whatever. That you're picking a team that you know is your team, rather than Emil Smith-Rowe, he's been playing really well, come on, let's get him in. At some point, you've got to say, stop, I've got 60-odd names on a list, I have to stop.
But I think he does have that, doesn't he? If we're going into a big game, he'd have a team. You know, it'd be Rice and Phillips and the defence that we know. It'd be Luke Shaw at left back. Like, we know it. But I think when you look at the Gallaghers and the Smith-Rowes, he's looking for that point of difference, which I think is to counter your point about in those moments where he's made the wrong decisions, he's not done the tactical tweak to win us the game. He's looking at some of those players. For example, a creative player in the central area. That's why he's tried Phil Foden. Conor Gallagher's showing potential in that role. Smith-Rowe. So, no, they're not going to be starting necessarily for England, but they could be coming off the bench for the last 20 minutes to try and impact the game.
I think it's a bit more than that. I think it's about, you know, including them. Like saying, you're on my radar, and you could be a part of, you know, you're on the right trajectory. You could be a big part of England's future. I kind of used to agree with Alison. I was looking at this list, and I remember when Tammy Abraham was given his debut in 2017. He'd been on loan at Bristol City the year before. He went to Swansea, he played 11 Premier League games. I think he'd scored 5 goals. I remember, like, the summer before, he got a new 50 grand a week Chelsea deal. And I just remember thinking, I can't remember a player having done so little and been rewarded so much, you know? And then,
well, if you look through the Chelsea Academy, there's a few.
But for England?
Oh, I see. Being rewarded. I thought you meant financially.
Financially rewarded. But, I thought you meant financially. The Championship. He was playing for Swansea. His season kind of went downhill after that as well. Hudson-Odoi, he played before he'd even started a Premier League game. So there have been moments in the last few years when I thought, yeah, this is odd. But I think it is about that collective idea. I think it's about A, looking at them, and saying, and B, saying, you guys are on my mind and you could be a part of England. You've got to, you know, you're close, and you could become a big part of the team if you continue on the same trajectory. So it's worked, let's be honest. Also, England, the biggest thing when you look at this is England have so many good players. It's embarrassing.
But, but that doesn't mean it works then, because you've got so many good players that it doesn't matter who you put on the list. You're going to have a good squad. The point is, the young players, for me, there are many who should be in the under-21s. And I know a couple of them were with the under-21s and came up because other players pulled out of the squad. But I think when you look at the overall picture, there are players who've been brought into the senior squad who've disappeared. They then don't go to the under-21s because apparently they feel like they are either senior players or they just want to, you know...
Sometimes that's their choice.
They want to use their clubs, exactly, and they don't want to come back into the international fold until they're in the seniors. So for me, that means it's been used the wrong way because there is still experience that they could be picking up being with the under-21s. And I don't feel like some of them, although they play for huge clubs, should be turning down the under-21. So he makes a rod for his own back in a way, because he's including players who he said himself, he doesn't want to rush players into the senior squad. He said that about Emil Smith Rowe a week ago. Now he's starting a game during that same window. You know, so...
But that was because people dropped out, though, to be fair.
I understand that, but you don't have to call up someone from the under-21s. You can bring a senior player. So for me, it's when you make that choice, everything that you've said goes out the window. Are you trying to rush them or not? Apparently not. You've said it yourself, but then you do it anyway. So my point is, what happens to Emil Smith Rowe when everyone's fit? He's not going to be in the England squad. I know Arsenal could keep going with their form and he could keep improving, but you think if everyone's fit, he's not going to be in the 23.
No, but he then has had a taste and experience of the seniors, so that if then Jack Grealish and Phil Foden got injured, then he can be called up with less concern about, oh, he's never been in before.
And I think it's actually quite easy to outgrow the under-21s, to be a regular in Arsenal's team or... in Conor Gallagher's case, in Crystal Palace's team, to be standout players in the Premier League and then go and play underage football is a bit odd. I still think
the experience is valuable, even for players playing, because I think the idea of going away with a group of players that you don't play with every single day and having to go and win games with 3 days training is still a valuable experience, whether you're playing with Harry Kane or whether you're playing with Flo Balogun. For me, that is a valuable experience for a young player, and they're still inexperienced. All the games count.
I would just say that I think, again, you got to put your faith in Gareth Southgate to be judging this right, because he also obviously sees there's a value in including them in the group of the senior team. And if that means that they'll play fewer games for the under-21s in future, so be it.
We should abandon under-21s, because the age that players are coming through now and blossoming is so much
not younger. In San Marino.
England wanted to throw out nations from the qualification, and they wanted to disband under-21s all because you had a really good qualification group.
No, we have
lots of good players coming through at a young age. It's not the same.
Just stick to under-19s, and then they're ready. Look at how young they're all. The reason he's making so many debutants is because it's young players are blossoming younger. Players are coming through younger now, and I can see why they're thinking under-21 is a demotion, because they've got peers playing for the national team who are like 6 months younger, 6 months older. It's just not got the status anymore.
This piece is coming together. If I Had Power at the FA by Alison Rudd is taking shape. I'm just saying, get rid of under-21s and don't pick anyone over the age of 28 either, because they're all too old, I imagine. Finally on this, Alison, the final point made in the piece by Willis Bennett, why can't Jack Grealish feature more often for England?
I suspect it's a personality issue, actually. I suspect either in training or direction given by Southgate, Grealish has not done as he's been asked, or there's a sense that he is so free-spirited, and the way his career has been forged, it was almost like he ran Aston Villa, had freedom. Dean Smith gave him freedom to do what he wanted at Aston Villa because it worked, and that doesn't work for Gareth Southgate. And he doesn't like players to be too, I can do everything. And I think he gives him a role and he doesn't probably stick to the role. Or if he does stick to the role, he looks uncomfortable in the role because he's not playing his normal, natural game. I think there's probably a very slight disconnect at what he wants Grealish to do and what he actually does. Whereas he's got some very willing, I mean, I think someone like Phil Foden probably does to the absolute letter exactly what Southgate wants. And he can change him positionally And he says, yes, boss, and does it exactly. There's just that sort of free spirit to Grealish, which I think he probably thinks I can do without it, actually. Don't need it.
I think Alison's probably right. I think when we a lot of the things we've talked about with Gareth Southgate in terms of, you know, if we were coming to a big game, knowing what his team would be, knowing what his starting 11 would be, often being criticised for that slight pragmatic approach, it comes down to that. I want Mason Mount over Jack Grealish because Mason Mount will track back that little bit more, is slightly more effective at pressing opposition defenders. Jack Grealish is a marvellous player and incredibly talented, but when it comes down to those moments, the fine margins, the games when you need to win 1-0 or by one goal against teams like Denmark and Colombia in international tournaments, you're going to pick those players, I think, if you're Gareth Southgate.
All right, that's England sorted. I think we're done on that conversation. They are through to the World Cup finals. Not going to be as easy for the other home nations if they've got any chance left at all. We'll discuss them next. But remember, if you're enjoying the podcast, rate us, leave us a review, and make sure you're subscribed.
Want flexibility? Take yoga. Want flexibility with your health insurance? Check out United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly medical, dental, and vision coverage that may be right for you. More at uh1.com.
If you're looking for plump lips that last, you need to know about Juvederm lip fillers. With Juvederm Volbella XC and Juvederm Ultra XC, your lip look, whether it's subtle or bold, can last up to 1 full year with optimal treatment and no additional maintenance. Find a licensed specialist and see if it's right for you at Juvederm.com today. That's Juvederm.com. Add fullness to lips in adults over 21 with Juvederm Volbella XC or Juvederm Ultra XC. Do not use if you have severe allergies or a history of severe allergic reactions, or if you're allergic to lidocaine or the proteins used in Juvederm. Tell your doctor if you have a history of scarring or taking medicines that decrease the body's immune response or that can prolong bleeding. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. As with all fillers, there's a rare risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. For full important safety information, visit Juvederm.com.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Well, elsewhere in World Cup qualification, in UEFA, of course, Wales are facing Belgium this evening. They do, though, have a playoff spot already confirmed through the Nations League. A point would virtually guarantee them a home playoff. Northern Ireland send Italy, the European champions, into the playoffs with a great goalless draw at Windsor Park, a game they really should have won, in my opinion, but they did allow Switzerland to qualify automatically, so Italy joined Portugal in the playoffs. Not great news for the likes of Scotland, who did earn themselves a playoff spot. They had a 2-0 win over Moldova that guaranteed it, but a fantastic 2-0 home win over Denmark made it 6 straight wins to end their qualification campaign. Steve Clark's side playing very, very well, and a home playoff as well at Hampden, which I think will be sensational. Go on then, Gregor. How good are you feeling about Scotland right now? How much have they improved under Steve Clark?
Before Gregor
How
speaks.
How long have you got?
Before Gregor speaks, because this is audio, Gregor looks like 6-year-old in a toilet.
I feel like it, honestly. This is... You'll think I'm being crazy here, but it's the best, probably the best team I've witnessed. Like, even thinking back to...
Better than the 98?
Absolutely. We were a team of triers with, like, John Collins as a flash of quality. And now I look at the team and suddenly I'd see a side from centre forward and centre half, we are well stocked with, like, seriously classy footballers.
Key areas of the pitch, but...
Yeah, but the thing that Clark has done is he's seen an opportunity in that. So he's handed Lyndon Dykes, Che Adams, who was outstanding against Denmark, opportunities. And at centre-half, people like Andy Considine, who's like in his mid-30s, Aberdeen, and he was the guy who came in and the yes sir, I can boogie thing. All of this, Declan Gallagher, another... Guys who play in Scotland, John Souter last night, who scored, he's had, I think, 3 Achilles ruptures. Like, he's had a nightmare 3 years. He sees an opportunity and he doesn't care where you're playing. And the guys are stepping up to the plate, and there's obviously a real kind of collective spirit about the squad as well. So absolutely, this is, you know, look, we've still got to qualify. We can't get too carried away, but this is the best team I can remember witnessing really in my adult lifetime.
What does it mean you're seeded now? I know you. Does that purely mean you've got a home game, or does it affect the opposition at all?
Yeah, it affects the opposition.
So will you avoid Italy?
Avoid Italy and Portugal in the semi-final, and we have a home game. So it was big. Look, the other thing to see is we had eight players on bookings. Steve Clarke could quite easily have gone, we've qualified, because obviously the Moldova game, sealed qualification. See, you're playing against one of the best teams in Europe currently, who are on track to have a 100% record in the group qualifying, who conceded their first goal against the Faroes on Friday. Like, we could have gone, all right, we'll rest a few, let's just take it easy. He said, let's go for it. And that's kind of a shift in mindset as well, I think. And you could see it in their play. No one got booked. They were full of intensity and hunger and drive and snapping at the tackles. And John McGinn, I can't say enough about this guy. He's like the most adored Scottish footballer for at least a decade. I'm trying to think back. James McFadden was really loved for Scotland as well, but he's something else. Everyone talks about the size of his backside, and he used it to great effect against Moldova. But his little back heel, he's got some quality as well. Mm. And when Clarke plays him in a more advanced role, he's outstanding. He's hounding players, but he's got a bit of quality about him as well. He's been Nathan Patterson, who came in the first game. He was brilliant. So, like, and I've said so much about Billy Gilmore. He's been transformative, because the speed and the kind of slickness of the passing in midfield now has been transformed since he came into the team. There was a move in the first half against Denmark where we played out of defence, looking at triangles in midfield, and Ryan Christie played an outside of the football through for Andy Robertson bombing through. And that didn't look like Scotland.
He's got 10 caps, Billy Gilmore. He's just 20 years old, so you know what that means. Scrap the Scotland under-21s, of course, because it's just a total waste of time, obviously. What do you think it would mean, Gregor? I will go back to you on this. If Scotland do make it through to the World Cup, just for the nation.
Look, it's already been a huge turnaround in the nation's attitude and kind of love for its football team. You saw, like, there was a sellout crowd. There's not been many sellouts at Hampden for quite a long time. And there's been two in a row now. And, you know, you saw midway through the second half, the team, the crowd belting out the national anthem with their phones kind of lit. Mm-hmm. And, like, you're seeing something, they're seeing a response. And I think the players love it as well. You know, there's a bit of connection. And absolutely, that's already there. But clearly, we need to go one step further. But, you know, you name these teams, there's some big nations in the what are they called now? The
playoffs.
Sorry.
Yeah.
There's some big nations in the playoffs. But Scotland at home first in the semi-final, and we've just beaten one of the top teams in Europe. I don't think we've got much to fear right now.
There's a bigger fairy tale in all of this qualification process, though, which I do feel I want to mention, which is Serbia and Aleksandar Mitrovic, who missed the penalty that meant Serbia did not make the Euros, but he scored the winning goal to beat a very, very strong Portugal team. And I just want to say that it's been like one of those weird things that Mitrovic is on fire in the Championship and he barely summoned a shot in the Premier League. And there's this thing, oh, well, you know, obviously defences in the Championship are just not good enough. And that's all it is. But that Portugal defence was, you know, A-star level. And I'm just so pleased for him, because it must be difficult to have... We talk about clubs having yo-yo careers. He's an individual with a yo-yo career, and he's hit absolute rock bottom because he is the most passionate player for his country I've ever interviewed. He loves his country, and for it to be sort of his fault that they didn't make the Euros and to have got them through for the World Cup, I think is a beautiful, beautiful story.
And a beautiful story that you can read more about, Hugh, in the Times today, because Bill Edgar's written a fantastic stats fest all about Mitrovic, and he scored 44 goals in 69 games for Serbia, which is pretty remarkable. But he's only scored one penalty, and he's only played the full 90 in 29 of those 69 games. That is pretty remarkable, as Alison says.
Listen, I really like Mitrovic. I just don't think he has the attitude to play at a lower half team in the Premier League. He gets really frustrated when he doesn't score. He's just one of those people. He just can't stand it when he doesn't score. He loves it when he does. He's got a big smile on his face. I've been to Fulham during the playoffs when there was no crowd, and honestly, Mitrovic was cheering on his team. He was injured for the whole game, just bellowing out from Craven Cottage. But you see him when he was at Newcastle and when Fulham were in the lower end of the Premier League, and obviously it's very frustrating for a striker when you're not at a great side, and he's just not the same character. And I think when he's happy, he scores loads of goals, and when he's not, he doesn't. So it's nothing to do with the Championship. It's to do with him. If he can find some sort of happiness and joy scoring 7 goals a season at the bottom end of the Premier League, then I think we'd see him in the bottom end of the Premier League. He's made a bunch of money too, so I don't feel sorry for him.
He's got a better goals per game internationally than Cristiano Ronaldo. Just saying.
Well, Ronaldo's obviously average, isn't he?
I was just going to say he needs to take a leaf out of Che Adams' book, really, I think.
Yeah, play for Scotland. It's too late for that. Listen, Mitrovic and Serbia had a fantastic evening out in Portugal, so thank you, Alison, for mentioning that. And there were some shocks, and obviously the playoffs will be very interesting given some of the big, big names that will be in it. We'll come back to international football, I guess, a little bit later on by talking about the greatest British player of all time to end the podcast. But up next, we're going to talk about Dean Smith, who's got the manager's job at Norwich. The former Aston Villa manager, Dean Smith, named the Norwich City head coach on a 2.5-year deal. He was appointed just 8 days after being sacked at Villa Park, and he, of course, replaces Daniel Farker. He will be a quiz answer for years to come, because when he returns to the Premier League, he will manage back-to-back games against the same opponent, Southampton. That is the first time it's happened in Premier League history. He was off on holiday and had to come back to get his contract sorted at Carrow Road. Is it a good appointment, Tom? What do you think?
Yeah, definitely. Much better than Frank Lampard, I would say, if I had the choice between the two. Look, Norwich look incredibly leaky at the back. We talked on a previous show about Dean Smith, and we all felt unanimously that he should have been given more time at Villa. Alisson mentioned it, what he did in terms of making them more solid after the kind of coronavirus break and making sure they stayed up. If he can have that same simple impact at Norwich, that gives them the fighting chance. And I think that's probably one of the reasons he was chosen. That kind of tactical tweak that he showed at Villa, well, probably more than a tweak, but that kind of work, if he can do that at Norwich, then it'll be a good appointment, because it at least then gives them a solid foundation and it gives them a fighting chance. Because at the minute, you know, all the debate is around what's the point of Norwich in the Premier League. Dean Smith can hopefully give them a point.
Can he?
I think that's his biggest challenge, actually, just kind of being able to change the mindset. And we've got Southampton, Wolves and Newcastle next, and it would be very important for him, if he's going to have any chance in changing that mindset, to get some points in those games. So I think he needs to hit the ground running. He doesn't have the same tools to work with defensively. You know, we've spoken about Gibson, Hanley, Kabak. They've not looked great. There's been an issue at left back too. Brandon Williams was improved against Brentford, but he's had a pretty tough start to his career at Carrow Road. Look, there's some easy wins, I think, and one is putting Billy Gilmour in. I don't speak with absolute bias there, but it's no problem. And Todd Cantwell, because it's been very strange with a team that's got such a dearth of creativity that he's been banished to the under-23s. I think, you know, Todd Cantwell, there are kind of Instagram posts saying thanks for the memories and stuff to Daniel Farke, but also added that we didn't always see eye to eye. And, you know, I think that was being quite diplomatic. They've had endured a bit of a fiery relationship. So I think getting him back in the fold is a no-brainer. And Billy Gilmour finding, you know, he started 4 of the first 5 games and then he's not been seen even off the bench since. So, you know, we've seen in the last week how good he is. So the other thing is, I think is quite interesting about this, is part of the reason he lost his job at Villa was the fact that they lost a big player in the team, and the money that was spent on his replacements haven't hit the ground running. Norwich did the same, and one of the players they signed to replace him was to replace Grealish was Buendia, and the players that Norwich have brought in since haven't hit the ground running. So much as it would have been the case if he'd stayed at Villa, getting the most from those new arrivals will be equally as important at Norwich. And I think probably will define whether he's a success or a failure this season.
I think Norwich are quite lucky, actually, because they've got a respected and very good, passionate coach who has a point to prove. I was trying to explain to someone why on earth, if you're Dean Smith, you don't think, oh, you know, Villa were my childhood club. It was my ultimate job. They've let me go. I'm just going to take a break. And there's a lot of reasons why he's not taking a break. There are more would-be coaches than there are jobs. So if there's a club interested in you, you can't afford to take a holiday. You have to take the job that's come up. And also, it must feel strange. It's not a normal sacking, I don't think, with Dean Smith. I think he genuinely was shocked. I think he felt he could turn it around. And he's being given a chance. It's not with Villa. It's not like Villa changed their mind about Steven Gerrard and said, sorry, we made a mistake because the media backlash has been really horrible. We don't want that image. But he has been given an immediate chance to show that the with parallel problems, and there are, I mean, there are worse problems at Norwich, but they're parallel. He can show Villa that they were wrong. If it wasn't Stephen Gerrard in charge at Villa, I would say I'd really like Norwich to escape and Villa to go down now. But I'm not going to say that now.
No, I think it's a good fit. I think, you know, Norwich have been slagged off a lot because of how weak their performance was the last time in the Premier League and the start of the season. You know, they're accused of lacking ambition and whatnot. But a big club, passionate fan base, good infrastructure, and he's got 27 games to keep a club in the Premier League. I don't think there's any other team in the Premier League would probably give him a job. He'd probably be looking at a Championship job.
He is essentially looking at a Championship job given Norwich's
position. Well, you can say that, but position. He's got 27 games to change that.
And his reputation won't be dented if they do go down, as long as they go down with more fight than they're currently showing.
Exactly.
Can he keep them up?
I don't think it's beyond the realms, but I think defensively they are in trouble still. So,
what do you think?
No, well, I mean, I'd said they'd go down on a previous show, so I can't change my mind now just because
they've got Dean Smith.
No, but I think what he'll do...
If they sign Messi, you could change your mind. Yeah. Why can't you change your mind about the manager?
He wouldn't fit. They've got Todd Cantwell. but I think, just going back to another point Gregor made about, you know, morale being quite low and Cantwell sending messages on Instagram. When you think about Smith, Jack Grealish putting messages on social media about how brilliant... People love him. He's clearly a very, very popular coach, as well as, you know, having something about him in terms of his footballing management ability. He's clearly a very popular man. And I think that's why it's another good appointment for Norwich, a club where they're feeling a little bit down in the dumps. Everyone's giving them a kicking on the pitch and off the pitch. Someone like Dean Smith is a good appointment for that. So I don't think they'll keep him up, but I think he will definitely improve their season.
I like Dean Smith, but I don't know. I just don't know about this one.
You're a Smith skeptic, aren't you?
Yeah, I was unconvinced by... You know, maybe it was just the luck that kept them in the Premier League the first time around. Yeah. Obviously, they finished 11th last season, which is a fantastic achievement. But without Jack Grealish, they were a very poor side. So the fact that he couldn't get them to a better place without Grealish on the pitch, and I know everyone's affected by losing their best player, but the fact that it all gravitated around him was, for me, it says a little bit about the tactics. And obviously, when he left, the tactics this season haven't been great, and he's lost 5 in a row and he's got sacked. So I'll wait and see. I think I'm not going to judge him on this season, though. I want to see what he does if they do get relegated in the Championship next year. If he brings them back up, I will change my opinion completely on Dean Smith.
But
I can
if you
promise
were Delia Smith, you wouldn't get Pochettino in, would you? I mean, you've got to be realistic.
Well, why wouldn't you get Pochettino in? I don't. he seems to be the better manager of the two. If you had the chance,
but he's not. But Pochettino is not going to Carrow Road.
No, I know that. But I'm not here saying that they should have hired someone else in particular. I'm just saying I have my reservations about the quality, tactically in particular, of Dean Smith as a manager.
I think a cross Dean Smith is going to be a very good Dean Smith.
Okay, well, we'll wait and see how cross he is then when he takes on Southampton at the weekend, and we'll see if he gets Norwich to winning ways as well. Up next, we're going to talk about the greatest British player of all time. Stay with us on The Game. Right, to end this week's podcast, after Gareth Bale's 100th Wales cap, you can, by the way, read a great profile of his career, his life journey. It was written by Gary Jacob, who've done some great work over the last few days on Wales. So just search for Gareth Bale if you've got the Times app or you're on the website. It has led to a further debate, though, in the Times today. Who is the greatest British player of all time? Bale, 100 Wales caps. He's been sensational. He's won himself 4 Champions Leagues as well. And some people, particularly in the modern era, regard him as the greatest British player. But there are some big names with even bigger views. Henry Winter, says Bobby Charlton of England. Jonathan Northcroft, representing Scotland, has gone for Dennis Law. Alison Rudd, says Wales. John Charles at Michael Grant, Scotland there. Graham Souness, incredible shout. Gary Jacob, says Gareth Bale of Wales. James Gearbrand, Wayne Rooney of England. Gregor Robertson, the man himself, Kenny Dalglish of Scotland, and Paul Hurst, representing Northern Ireland, with the greatest shout for me, Georgie Best. So who do we think it is, Tom?
It's none of them, obviously. Obviously. No, I mean, there's lots and lots of excellent shouts there. But I mean, I was thinking it in the context of a great story. Now, Hugh, I love a rom-com, me. Mm-hmm. I like a happy story. That's why I was having a go at Alison earlier for, you know, let's just enjoy ourselves. And in the international context, you don't get many better narratives than David Beckham's. Sent off against Argentina, scores the penalty a few years later. And also, the lad was a trier. I love a trier as well. Like, I don't think he was particularly naturally blessed with footballing ability. He just worked really hard at taking really, really good free kicks, corners and set pieces and crossing the ball. And he loved playing for England. And he had a phenomenal trophy record as well. So I'm going to go for Bex.
But he didn't have to juggle nonsense. National service with football, did he?
No, he didn't. But he did.
That's a proper romantic story.
He did have to juggle dating Victoria Beckham, which, you know, is
it's similar.
Is a hell of an ask, I'd say.
Another point for the piece there. Bring back national service for England footballers, says Alison Rudd. But David Beckham, I do think he's underrated. Even you there saying he wasn't that gifted. He was, actually.
No, he was, but do you know what I mean? In context of George Best, the last player you mentioned,
yeah,
in that
absolutely
list, you
know? Yeah, in the context of the others, yes. But I think he, you know, he was a grafter. I agree with you on that. He had some phenomenal parts of his game, actually. Yeah. I think if England had him now, particularly towards the end of his career, late 20s, when he could have played central midfield, we would love it right now, to be perfectly honest.
What are you looking for here? We're looking for someone who is iconic status north and south of the border for two of the biggest clubs in Britain during their peak years. He won 9 major trophies for Celtic, Kenny Dalglish, and 15 for Liverpool, including 3 European Cups and 6 league titles. He's still Scotland's most capped player, 102. He's tied with Dennis Law on 30 goals. I think that's hard to beat. And would you not agree, Alison?
Of course, Kenny's a giant of the game, but he's not the greatest British footballer of all time, because that's John Charles. Because that's who I argued for. Who did have to juggle national service, who was as brilliant as a centre-back as he was as a centre-forward. None of the people in the list have that, can do that. They could play equally well at the back or up front. He was at Leeds United. He went to Juventus. I mean, unbelievably, he just stormed Serie A, came third in the Ballon d'Or. I even like the fact when he came back to Britain, he struggled because he'd become so imbued with the Italian style of football. He couldn't cope with the English game anymore. And everyone who was involved says if he had been fit in the 1958 World Cup for their game against Brazil, they would have won the World Cup. I think his story is just so romantic, if you want to talk about romance, Tom.
Fair play.
I like it. I like John Charles. I've seen very, very little, I have to admit.
Well, I agree.
But the tales of John Charles are up there, I think. But it's hard to look beyond Gareth Bale, who I think without injury, imagine Gareth Bale if he'd been fit for like 50% of his career. And come on, the other 50%, obviously. But I mean, just imagine how good he would have been. The moments that he's given us in the modern era. Let's take it from 1990 onwards.
I know, but he's as known as for his golf as much as his football, and I don't think you can be the greatest if that's part of your narrative. We're heading down the narrative.
Oh, is it narratives now? Is it?
No, look, it's always narratives.
It's always narratives. It's my favourite word.
Since 1990, firstly, every professional footballer is very good at golf since 1990. So,
but they don't have a chant. They don't have a chant about it. Wales, golf, Madrid. Come on.
I think, do you know what though? I do think Hurstie's shout on George Best. Come on.
I mean, yeah, that's the easy one. I was discussing it with him. I was like, you're going to go for George Best? He's like, yeah, I'm going to win this, aren't I?
Has the voting closed?
No. So the readers will be able to
vote. Do you
want to
go for a second name, dude?
Yeah, Alison's like, well, just now we're on it.
Can we edit the piece? No, John Charles is a fantastic shout. Some great players there. As I say, the only name I disagree with, Graham Souness. Come on, Michael Grant, what were you thinking? Listen, thanks for being with us on the the Game podcast. Plenty still to come. We'll be back on Thursday, so thanks for waiting an extra 24 hours. Remember, if you're enjoying the podcast, rate us, leave us a review, make sure you're subscribed, and make sure you're subscribed to the Times and the Sunday Times as well. If you sign up today, you will get yourself 1 month free. Just go online to check it out. It's thetimes.co.uk/thegame. We'll see you on Thursday. Take care.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Off Air, the podcast. With Jane Garvey and Fee Glover.
I go to the sink and I have some cheese.
Keep your cheese in the sink.
Doesn't everybody?
Every Monday to Thursday, Jane and Fee keep the microphones on after their Times radio show.
I think if we were to do a Mr. and Mrs.
Oh,
no,
yes.
How would that go in the booth?
Badly.
It would go very badly.
Unencumbered and off air.
Two tiny women with gobs.
Off Air, the podcast. Now available on the Times radio app.